go on strike will be made by the bargaining committee. The bargaining committee is three people who, some of them formerly worked at STA, some of them currently work at STAs, who basically represent us, represent the union in negotiations with McGill. And so the strike vote has given the bargaining committee the authority to declare a strike at any moment that they consider strategic for TAs in negotiations. And that moment will basically be determined by the process of negotiations. And, you know, when the bargaining committee feels that we have reached a moment that we cannot make any more progress without going on strike.
Yeah, how likely is it, if we're, like, being realistic here, from what you're hearing from the TAs, like, is it kind of a done deal that there's going to be a strike this semester?
It's definitely not a done deal. The bargaining committee either has wrapped up or is wrapping up a negotiations session with McGill as we speak. So it's definitely still possible for McGill to avert a strike by proposing a contract to TAs that goes in the direction of our bargaining mandate, which has not been the case so far.
Yeah, I'd like to hear about what specifically TAs at McGill are demanding, and, like, just in general, why you've reached this point, what the situation is that's, you know, led you to say, okay, we might actually have to strike to get what we think we deserve in this case.
Mm-hmm. So a bargaining mandate, as you mentioned a bit in your introduction, asks for a substantial raise for TAs that places McGill in a similar pool as other universities of the U15, the group of Canadian research, major Canadian research universities, when it comes to TA hourly rates. And we're also asking for a cost of living adjustment to be incorporated into this pay increase, which would mean that if inflation continues at record high levels, our wage would be increased year to year to reflect this. We're asking for healthcare funds because we feel that the current healthcare that is available to TAs through McGill does not address the needs of many of us, particularly international and transgender students. And finally, we're asking for the indexation of TA hours to student enrollment, because we've witnessed cuts in TA hours in many departments when student enrollment has risen or stayed the same, which is really jeopardizing the quality of education at McGill. And McGill has refused to address any of these demands, has given us a very low raise of 2.25% in the first year of a contract and subsequently 1.25%, and is completely refusing to address our demands for healthcare and indexation, which are really essential to our bargaining mandate.
Yeah, and, you know, that's, like, what we saw last fall, right, with the Common Front and the public sector strikes, is they were saying, like, our increases are not even going to keep up with inflation. So they're effectively pay cuts when you look at, like, what people's purchasing power is. Is that the case with McGill TAs? Is that what you're saying?
Oh, yeah, that's definitely what we're saying. We consider the offer that McGill has made to us, their latest offer, as being an effective pay cut when we take into account inflation and purchasing power. Absolutely.
Yeah, and, you know, you're saying that the hours are being cut as well. Like, can you give me something that's a little bit more concrete? What does that look like when we're looking over the past, I don't know, 5 years, 10 years? What are we talking here?
Right. So we have seen, so the situation really varies dramatically across departments. We know that, for example, recently in psychology, TAs that used to have 180-hour contracts had sold their contracts, converted to 150-hour contracts, and they were still responsible for the same number of students. So it means that in many departments, right now I'm giving the example of psychology, the actual number of hours that TAs are given are being cut back.
but they're still, like, having the same workload, you're saying?
They are still having the same workload, so it basically means that TAs in such situations have to, you know, often ask to skim student papers and are blamed for taking too long for when, you know, when they're grade. They're not able to meet with students. So it's really impacting really the quality of education and also encouraging TAs to, pressuring TAs to work over the hours, essentially, to be able to deliver any form of education that meets a, you know, a minimal standard of decency, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, full disclosure, used to be a McGill TA, so I'm speaking from experience when I say that, like, the kind of standard is skimming. Mm-hmm. Like, that is what is being asked, especially if, you know, first year, second year courses, there's simply no way with the hours that you, the time you have even to do grading, like, that you can be as in-depth as maybe the students think that you might, you know, be. It's just, you know, it's not tenable. And so you're saying that you'd like then to see some kind of, like, standard set so that based on how many students are in a course, like, you know, you would have to have 180 hours in a contract, which I know has been standard for a long time, or, you know, in the nuts and bolts of it, what exactly in a collective agreement would prevent that from, that kind of degradation from happening to the kind of care and attention that students would get on their work?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very good question. Well, the union acknowledges that there are vast disparities in the modalities of teaching across different departments and courses. So the union actually has given McGill a lot of flexibility in trying to come up with a solution that would address this degradation of the quality of education that comes with TA hours being cut. So we have, we're really open to different sorts of mechanisms that we could discuss at the table. Such mechanisms could include standards that are set and made transparent by department chairs and that could therefore vary across departments depending on the nature of the courses that are being delivered and the nature of TA work that these courses require. So that's one example. But really, we're open for McGill to also try to come up with their own idea for a mechanism that could address this problem. And McGill has so far refused to even participate in this conversation at all. Yeah, with the union.
Why don't you give me a sense of, like, what they have said at the bargaining table as much as you can? Because mm-hmm. I asked McGill for comment before we chatted today, and they just straight up said, no, we're not going to comment, which is very common when, mm-hmm. like, bargaining is underway. Is there anything you can tell me about the response? You know, there's, like, a number of points you brought up. Is there something that the university might be more open to if they're not open to, like, let's say, salary gains? Is there anything that they've sort of, like, dangled as the carrot here?
Right. So, well, what I can say is that so far McGill has only been willing to negotiate on, what they consider a salary gain, which is 2.25% increase in pay in the first year of a contract and 1.25% subsequently. And, yeah, they have really refused to address any these other issues of healthcare and indexation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, Sequoia and Evelyn, you guys, being current undergrad students at McGill, like, feel free to jump in at any time if you've got questions. But when I hear the kind of demands that you have, the thing that strikes me is that, you know, you're comparing McGill's salary to the U15 university group. And if you look at, like, the specific ask on from AgSem, the universities are listed are places like U of T, Windsor, Waterloo, Ottawa, like, you know, Queens. These are, many of them are universities in Ontario where the cost of living is just much higher. often the tuition is much higher. Like, in Quebec, some of us grad students have access to in-province tuition that's substantially lower, right? There's just a number of factors that might, at first glance, like, explain why the average for these universities is $46 per hour, whereas the average for McGill is $33 per hour. And, you know, I can imagine being an undergrad and looking at that and saying, like, okay, what are the TAs complaining about? Like, what's your response to that?
Right. Well, so the standard of TA pay at McGill is the highest in Quebec overall. And TAs in other universities in Quebec are also fighting for wage increases. And actually, TAs who are bargaining at UQAM recently publicized a research that compares salaries with, for example, the salaries of TAs at 200 universities while taking into account disparities in cost of living. And they have found that even when disparities in cost of living are taken into account, McGill TAs are still significantly underpaid compared to Toronto TAs. And the other thing is that the universities that we compare ourselves to not only include universities in cities that are really expensive, like Toronto, but actually also include universities located in cities that have a cost of living that is actually quite comparable to Montreal, such as Ottawa or Kingston, when we look at Queen's Universities, where TAs are paid around $45 an hour. So there is clearly a problem of TAs being massively underpaid in Quebec in general and at McGill as well. And the other thing I'd like to comment on is that McGill's principal salary, which is around $500,000, is actually quite comparable to the salary received by U of T's principals. So we're also asking, why do senior administrators receive salaries that are comparable to the salaries of top universities in different provinces when TAs are so significantly underpaid?
I mean, it's a fair question, right? And at McGill, you know, I think you're going to hear a lot of people saying, well, now is not the right time because of the impact of the, you know, the out-of-province tuition hikes and other tuition measures being put in place by the Quebec government. Like, McGill has this hiring freeze, right, that's affecting faculty and it's affecting administrators and, like, obviously every student. I mean, not to speak for the McGill community, but you could probably go across campus and people are going to want deep saney principal of McGill to, like, take a funding cut, or they don't care, like, what any of the VPs make. They don't think that they should be making as much as they are. I don't think that is, like, in question at all. But I think maybe where you might get more pushback is, like, from even people in, like, faculty or lower admin roles who are saying, like, we can't even hire anybody right now. Like, if a prof leaves, how are we going to get somebody for the department? Like, maybe people are sympathetic, but just feel like, you know, it's kind of a rough time to be mobilizing. What's the kind of, you know, mood among AGSEM and among TAs with that really big obstacle to solidarity that is this tuition hike from the government?
Mm-hmm. So AGSEM's position on that is first to remind people that TAs represent a very small portion of McGill's budget. McGill spends annually $13 million on TA when their operating budget is close to $1 billion. So we're looking at less than 2% of their operating budget here, which is kind of crazy to think about when you consider that TAs really, how essential TAs are to the university's mission, right? TAs really bear the brunt of delivering education to students, of course, alongside faculty and course lecturers. And we also want to emphasize that McGill's endowment is the third largest in Canada after the University of Toronto and the University of British Columbia. So McGill is still in a financial position that is really privileged when we compare, you know, McGill to other universities, you know, at the national level. So there's really no reason for McGill to bring up this excuse of the Quebec's government policy when it comes to raising the salary of GAs and meeting all the demands of healthcare indexation.
Yeah. I mean, looking ahead to the end of term, you know, I've seen some stuff from you guys about scabbing, mm-hmm. just saying, if we go on strike, you know, please don't take a job as a substitute grader. You know, please stand in solidarity with the TAs. You know, if you do go on strike, what are some of the possibilities that you're thinking will happen in terms of grading, in terms of, you know, the end of term, and I guess both in terms of what the university will choose to do and the impact that this might have on undergrads who, you know, at McGill at least, don't have such a great history of labor solidarity and might be pretty ticked off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the outcome really pretty is going to be pretty uncertain. I don't also want to underestimate the ability for undergrads to show solidarity with us. And I think, you know, there has been quite a lot of frustration brewing at McGill amongst undergrads on a variety of issues. But the outcome from undergrads is really going to depend on the length of the strike and basically how long it takes for McGill to come back to us with a fair offer. It is true that we have been asking people to not scab, and some forms of scabbing that McGill may encourage, such as hiring undergraduate or non-TA graduate workers to replace TAs, is outright illegal. So that's an important thing to point out. And we're also asking faculty to stand in solidarity with TAs and to not take on work that is assigned to TAs in TA workload forms, which are the kind of agreements TAs, the forms that list the tasks that TAs are responsible for.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, you know, it's been great. Fanny, thank you so much for coming on CKUT. And we'll have to be, you know, all of us watching what happens next. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
If it sounds like Montreal, it sounds like CKUT. CKUT's annual funding drive is back, and this year we're celebrating the city that made us. From Friday, March 15th to Sunday, March 24th, tune in for an earful of Montreal-made magic. Your favorite programmers will be live in studio and live streaming online for the first time ever. Tune in online, on the good old-fashioned radio, or join us in person. CKUT friends and family will be providing the tunes for an opening party at Bar La Marche à Côté on March 14th and a closing night on March 23rd at Nouvel Établissement. Stay tuned at our website for other events that put the fun in fundraising. Don't miss these celebrations of community radio and sounds of the city from your favorite local DJs. We need $50,000 to keep CKUT on the map. Powering a nonprofit radio station is more expensive than ever. Will you answer the call of your community before it's too late? Donate now by visiting ckut.ca/donate or by calling 514-907-9424. CKUT 90.3 FM, the sound of Montreal since 1987.
Hi, you're currently listening to Unfit to Print. This is a McGill Daily radio show. You're here with Evelyn Logan, your host, and this is the first show. So it's going to be on the subject of our very last editorial, which was called The Breaking of the Floor Fellowship. And this concerned McGill's treatment of the floor fellows and the abrupt deletion of this position for the following academic year. So today we're going to be talking with Graham Scott, who is the VP of the Floor Fellow Union. Are you there, Graham?
I am. Hi.
Hi. So break it down for us. Tell us the entire story. Tell us how McGill told you that the positions were going to be gone.
Yeah, well, I was thinking about that today when I saw this, that question was going to be addressed. And the thing is, it's a really big question that actually goes back like 10 years to 2014. Mm. So what I'll start with is kind of the events of the last month, and then I'll talk you through sort of what we've seen leading up to that.
Yeah.
So back in February on the 15th, all of the floor fellows with 3 hours notice were called into a Zoom meeting with the Associate Director of Residence Life. So we weren't given any notice of what this Zoom meeting was. We hadn't been told that, there was the possibility of the floor fellow position being eliminated or that any of these discussions had been happening. All that we knew was that Student Housing and Hospitality Services was carrying out what they called a strategic assessment following the news of the tuition hike. So we were called into the Zoom meeting.
Oops, sorry, I hate to cut in. I want to know, do you know what a strategic assessment is, or could you explain a little bit what that would mean?
Let's get to that, because that's another really big thing I wanted to talk about, actually.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah. So we were called into the Zoom meeting where we had our cameras off. We couldn't turn our cameras on. The chat was turned off, and we couldn't turn our mics on. And the associate director, who is basically our boss's boss, read out a speech basically saying that following the strategic assessment, it had been decided that the floor fellow role was no longer necessary to the university in fulfilling its mission, its priorities, and that this was going to be the last cohort of floor fellows. So floor fellows would not be rehired for the next academic year.
Wow. So when you got that news, and I can't even imagine being in a Zoom like that, how did you feel? I mean, I know you said that you weren't expecting it, but, you know, as you say, it goes back to 2014. Did you have an inkling that something like this would happen?
Mm-hmm. Well, the initial reaction amongst the floor fellow community was definitely sort of shock and grief and a lot of anger and a lot of questions because, as the staff who actually do this job, who live in the residence, who support our students one-on-one, we are really keenly aware of the impact that floor fellows have. And, you know, given that almost all of us were formerly residents in these buildings in our first year, we know that it's not true to say that the floor fellow position can be adequately replaced by, you know, any of these number of, as other student support offices that have been brought up by McGill in justifying this decision. So, you know, we talk about, they talked about the wellness hub, the Office of Sexual Violence Response and Reporting. They talked about the, online telehealth services like Maple or Keep Me Safe or the Office of the Dean of Students. And as floor fellows who work in these residences, work with the students and have been residents ourselves, we understand really keenly that those kind of impersonalized services where, you know, you don't necessarily know the people involved, you can't access them all the time, you have to book online, really doesn't, you know, it's not even accurate to say that they don't fill the role of the floor fellow or the floor fellows, because they're not even aiming to do the same thing. You know, the role of the floor fellow is to be live-in peer support that is a text message away or a knock away or down the hall. And we can get into that, you know, in a little bit more detail maybe down the line. But, you know, initially the reaction from us was absolutely shock and just concern about, you know, what this is going to mean for, you know, our residents in future years. We're really concerned about the negative impact this is going to have.
Exactly. And what I really want to bring up, and this came up as the Ed Board, as we were writing our editorial about this topic, we really felt, I was one of the only people in the room that was still currently in residence, and I felt as though there was a large disconnect between what the McGill students that are in residence and versus students that are out of residence, and how they really feel about floor fellows. I mean, to me personally, the floor, it's just such a nice resource, almost like a net to catch you if you're falling down. Like, and I feel like how I explained it to them, like, to me, floor fellows are like the training wheels on your bicycle. You know, as you're preparing to like strike out and live on your own, a floor fellow is someone who's actually there. And like you said, like a knock away right down the hall, that can help you with that transition, and it doesn't feel like these other institutions that they brought up, the Wellness Hub, where there's just such a large disconnect, and it's very impersonal. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's not me denigrating any of those services. You know, I've used the local wellness advisor. I direct people to those resources, and that's a huge part of our job, is to be figures in these residents who know these resources. So one thing that's a part of Four Fellow Training is something called, and I mentioned this before, the activities fair. It's not that. It's called the Services Roundtable, mm-hmm. Where we have all of the McGill student service offices come in. So, you know, financial aid, OSFIRST, the Black Students Network, the First People's House, the Office of, I don't remember exactly what it is, but it's the Office of Spiritual and Religious Life. Mm-hmm. The athletics staff. So all of these different services come in and explain to us in a lot of detail exactly what they can and can't do, what service they provide, how to access them, and when to direct students to them for support. So the role of a Four Fellow is not to, you know, be any of these services. You know, we're not mental health professionals. We're not counselors. We're not, you know, we're not trained to provide professional support, you know, in cases of sexual violence. But our job is to know how to offer short-term intermediary support and how to direct residents to the services that they need and to be the bridge. So, you know, when a student comes to us and they're in crisis, we're the ones who are able to say, hey, you should talk to an LWA about that. You know, I know the LWA. The LWA is great. Let me make a referral right now. And, you know, when we look at, the state of some of those services where they're really overburdened and they're really under-equipped to support all of these residents adequately, you know, for example, right now, the local wellness advisor in residence, there is one counselor who is dedicated to supporting the over 3,000 students in residence. That's simply not adequate. Mm-hmm. And when you try and book online for a one-on-one support session with that counselor, she is actually completely booked up as we speak right now.
Wow.
For the entire rest of the year. So if a resident were to come to me right now and say, hey, I heard about the LWA, can I talk, you know, how do I talk to them? You know, they would look online and it would be fully booked.
Right.
So inaccessible. So one of the services Four Fellows provide is being able to, in cases like that, you know, because we have that established professional relationship with the local wellness advisors and with these services, we can send them an email or file what's called a care report saying, hey, I'm really concerned about this student. Do you think we can figure something out? Mm-hmm. You know?
Yes.
So we're really crucial to help bridge that gap, help those residents navigate that bureaucracy. And another really essential thing is kind of helping residents advocate for themselves. Because I think something that we're all very aware of is that it's really hard, you know, when you're in that transitional period, you're living alone for the first time, maybe you're dealing with a lot of these issues kind of for the first time in your life, it can actually be really hard to take that first step to go ask for help. Mm-hmm. And to identify, you know, that you are someone who deserves help and needs help. And a Floor Fellow is someone who, because we, you know, we live there on the floor, we have an individual relationship with our residents, we can kind of keep tabs on them and kind of keep our finger on the pulse and say, hey, you know, how are things going? Tell me what's going on. And, you know, through that conversation, through that casual conversation, you can sometimes draw out, you know, what you can offer to support a resident.
Yeah, I totally agree.
I just want to go back to something that Evelyn mentioned, actually, just your last question, just about kind of the first year perspective. And I know that after the announcement came, you guys kind of put out a Google form asking for some consultations, you know, just hearing from students. Like, have you been speaking with first year students, like in residence, actually? And what have they said, if so?
Mm-hmm. Well, we have. So we've been speaking to a huge variety of people. So a lot of the people who respond to that form, it's about 500 responses right now.
Wow.
We're going to be publishing that testimony. We're going to be publishing that testimony hopefully by Sunday or Monday, actually. So stay tuned for that. There'll be an open letter going out. But, you know, we've had responses from lots of current residents, lots of residents going back to the 90s, you know, residents from 10, 20 years ago. And, you know, we see the huge variety of stuff that Four Thumbs do reflected in the, you know, the variety of those responses. So in a lot of cases, we have people saying, you know, Floor Fellows made me feel welcome. They made me feel safe. I know there's someone to talk to when I need them. And sometimes you have responses saying, my Floor Fellow saved my life. You know, my Floor Fellow prevented me from taking my own life. My Floor Fellow prevented me from dropping out. My Floor Fellow helped me when my friend was experiencing an overdose. And, you know, we've seen that reflected in our conversations with the current residents, you know, living here this year. You know, we've had some really tremendous, overwhelming support from those residents. I do also want to acknowledge that, you know, in the for the sake of, you know, being open and transparent, we have had some testimony or some, you know, responses from residents that are not so positive about Floor Fellows. We've had some people saying, yeah, I don't really know my Floor Fellow. I haven't talked to my Floor Fellow. My Floor Fellow has never messaged me. And I think that is actually really, really interesting and really telling, that when you look back two or three, even before COVID, really, you know, there was much more universal positivity about Floor Fellows than there are now. And I think that's something I want to get into, because it tells the story of how Floor Fellows really over the past 10 years have been systemically disempowered from doing our jobs well by policies that have come from McGill. And that's something that I really do want to touch on.
Actually, yeah, just on that, you know, I'm reading this article published by CTV News, and they quote McGill kind of saying, you know, Floor Fellows, like, they attend a 3-hour workshop at the beginning of the year, and then, you know, like, this doesn't make them counselors or experts. Their role, this is a quote, their role, quote, is solely to identify students who require assistance and escalate them to the appropriate resources. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I've heard a lot of, a lot of Floor Fellows talk about how they're actually acting as direct responders. I mean, is that part of your job description? Is that something that is actually required, or is that a Floor Fellows kind of going above and beyond? And how would you respond to McGill kind of framing the TA role in that way?
Floor Fellow.
You know, sorry, actually, the Floor Fellow. I'm so sorry.
I'm actually so glad that you brought up their comments on that CTV News article, because that I was really, really taken aback by those. So first of all, you know, one of the things they said is that Floor Fellows, you know, don't pay rent. They have a small tax deficit. That's just blatantly false, right? Like, that is just objectively false information. And you can look at our contracts or our job or our collective agreement and see that that's not true. Hmm. So Floor Fellows are actually charged for, you know, the privilege of living in our workplace. We are charged the maximum that an employer may charge under the Act Respecting Labor Standards, which is a piece of provincial legislation. So that comes out to about $60 per week. So if you put that over a paycheck, that's $120, right? So when we're only being paid for 13 hours a week at minimum wage, having $120 taken off of your paycheck is actually like a lot of money, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's important to remember that the reason we are supplied with a, you know, a room in these residences and a meal plan is for the same reason that, you know, you are supplied by your employer with the tools to do any kind of job. So if you're working in an office, you know, your employer gives you a work computer, your employer gives you an office, your employer gives you a desk and a chair. And that's not considered some kind of, like, sweet perk, right? It's just an essential tool to do the job. And the reason we have rooms in the residence is because we are live-in staff. It is a live-in job. So in order to do this job properly, we have to be living, we have to be proximate, we have to be there, you know, in the night, after hours, kind of ambiently around. You know, I run into my residents, just in my example, when I'm brushing my teeth, when I'm walking to class, when I'm sitting in the dining hall. You know, the other thing that McGill said in that those comments to CTV News that really irked me is, you know, they said, Floor Fellows, you know, we're not counselors. We're not, you know, we're not mental health experts. Which, like, yeah, obviously we're not counselors and mental health experts. Like, yeah, no one ever said that, right? you know, McGill is, like, and we never claimed that. And McGill is fully aware that we never claimed that. So it's really disingenuous. What I can point to is, like, what McGill themselves has said about the Fourth Bellow Rule and our role in mental health. So the resident's handbook, it actually says this. I'm reading from my own notes here. Floor fellows, upper year live-in student staff members, trained in first aid and crisis intervention, tasked with role modeling, peer, community building, and peer counseling. Right, so that says it right there. You know, McGill, I'll read more.
Mm-hmm.
This was the official webpage. Yeah, so McGill, until recently, had a little page on their website describing the floor fellows, which has since been made private.
Wow.
You can still access it via the Wayback Machine, which is what we did.
Mm-hmm.
To get this quote, they said, ultimately, the Floor Fellows are amazing resources for an abundant amount of diverse information and capable of providing much of the needed support for incoming students and are continually striving to build a community in which each and every student feels respected.
Yeah.
When you look at our own, the training we receive, we have a, I think it's more than a 3-hour workshop. It's, it's continual professional development. It's continual discussion. It's discussion with the local wellness advisors. And also we receive a lot of written material that we are expected to reference in an emergency situation. So our training includes detailed breakdowns of, for example, suicidal ideation, non-suicidal self-harm, disordered eating, how to, see when a student is experiencing crisis. We're trained in what's called kind of the student life cycle in first year, where, in September you start out super, happy and wide-eyed, and then you have midterms, and then it's December and you go home and you have all the emotions of going home.
Mm-hmm.
So, actually, we really do know what we're doing.
Right.
And McGill, McGill says and points students to us as the people to go to when you're in crisis. The associate director, Dan Fournier, said in August at the big general meeting introducing first-year students to McGill, that was in the stadium, that Floor Fellows were, I think he said, the most intelligent and dedicated staff that he's ever had the privilege of managing, when you go around the residences, you see McGill has put up posters or, signs on the elevator doors or up on the billboard saying, "You're not alone. Reach out to your floor fellow for support." So it's really, I have to be honest, it's really galling to see McGill, they train us, they direct students to us, they say that the floor fellows are this resource there to support you and they're going to make a difference and they're, they're here for you, and to publicly affirm us and to publicly make these statements, right? And then to turn around and not only try and hide the evidence of the statements they made, not only try and, privatize those that web page, but actually go on the CTV and make completely disingenuous claims that they know aren't true.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that totally feels like, I can't imagine how that would feel. To me, it just sounds like they're stabbing you in the back, basically. But I really had two things that I wanted to comment on that you said. The first one being, I had the privilege to speak with a couple different floor fellows from a couple different residences who mentioned to me that, especially with the payment they were getting and also their rent being taken out of that payment that they were getting, some months that they were breaking even. And that, in addition to really the weight of the job and the amount of tasks that you guys have to do, and especially highlighting all of the things, all the training that you guys get, I really feel like it's important to note that despite what the job description might be on a website, being a floor fellow and generating a community and building a community with your residents and really just even caring about 20 or 30 or sometimes, a lot of people that you're 45. Wow. It's a lot. So
it's a lot.
It's a lot. And that with not being paid at all, I really want you to bring it back to 2014 so we can understand how this position has really gotten to the state that it is right now.
Mm-hmm. So let's go back to 2014 when Floor Fellows first unionized. So at the time, I don't know how familiar people are anymore with the Sixth Floor Party and the protest in Morton Mendelson's office, but it was actually, it's funny because it was actually related to CKUT. So back in 2014, there was a very public spat between the deputy provost of student life and learning and kind of the McGill, you know, elements of the McGill community. And it's to do with funding for CKUT. And what ended up happening is that I think, you know, like some, like a lot of students, it was like somewhere in the double digits, occupied provost office for a couple days, which led to basically a real breakdown in trust, a real breakdown in the relationship between admin and the students.
Right.
Anyway, that's a whole other story. But among those, among some of those students who had occupied his office were two poor fellows. And the, you know, the student housing admin at the time made a big show of doing public consultation of, well, you know, what should happen? Should these four fellows be fired? You know, should they be allowed to keep their jobs? And there was a big open letter that went around with, you know, 60 signatures from four fellows. And, you know, the pretty overwhelming consensus of the McGill community was that these were two excellent four fellows and they should be kept on staff. Anyway, they were fired.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And when they were fired, they were also evicted from their homes. So this kind of brought things into really sharp focus for the four fellows. You know, there had been attempts to unionize before that.
Right.
But this was really, it was kind of the realization of the precarity of our jobs, kind of as like these at-will employees who were compensated with room and board.
Right.
And, you know, not, didn't have leases, didn't have a super clear-cut, you know, relationship with our employer. It wasn't formalized. And so that was the impetus for us to unionize. And the other big thing is that four fellows have always been really strong advocates of a harm reduction approach to residents. So rather than writing up a student and kicking them out when, you know, we see, you know, drug use or alcohol use or violations of policy, you know, our position has always been harm reduction, have always been, let's find a way to work with people so that we have eyes on what's going on and we make sure that people are not, you know, engaging in harmful behavior out of sight where we can't be there to assist them.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting is that this was actually McGill's own policy. You know, prior to the mid-2010s, there weren't really, there's a famous saying from, you know, that used to be, you know, put around in McGill residences, you know, 10 or 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Also, is it okay if I swear on the mic? Because otherwise,
you're all good.
It's fine. So it used to be, it was said that there were only two rules in residence. The first rule was respect, and the second rule was don't fuck with the fire equipment.
Yeah, I heard that. I heard that this year for sure.
And four fellows, we still kind of use that as like, okay, like, it boils down to that, or it should boil down to that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, in the years since, we've seen a real shift from a harm-reductive, community-based approach that we had previously into a very disciplinarian, a very abstinence-based, prevention-based approach.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, even in the last couple of years, we've seen those policies escalate. So as of this year, you cannot, you can't, for example, drink alcohol in residence outside of your room. So instead of, you know, having a beer with your friends in the common room and watching the hockey game, you're expected to be having a beer or maybe several beers behind closed doors in your room.
Right.
And what's the net result of that? It's that, you know, those kind of behaviors that are actually very, very normal and very healthy, like, you know, or, you know, many people consider that. I'm not going to come out and make a comment on recreational drug use or recreational alcohol use, because like my opinion doesn't actually matter, right? It's like those are things that people in our society choose to do, and it's fine, you know, it's fine. And so the result of that is that these, you know, what should be, what we should be doing is modeling healthy behaviors, modeling these behaviors in a safe community setting where there's not secrecy, there's not the threat of getting kicked out of residence, there's not the threat of discipline. And instead, those behaviors are driven behind closed doors where residents feel like they have to sneak around, right?
Right.
And the result of that is that there's a breakdown in the relationship between floor fellows and students because, you know, now we're put into a position where we have to be, like, the cops. We are expected to be writing residents up when we see violations of the alcohol policy or the drug use policy, you know. According to the rules right now in Res, you can't even have, like, drug paraphernalia, which means, like, a bong. You know, you can't have a bong or a pipe in your room.
Right.
Or not a pipe, but you know what I mean.
No, for sure, for sure.
Yeah, which it really makes it hard for us to be this peer support role.
I agree.
You feel like you can have a comfortable relationship with us.
Yes.
So that was a real, that was a real impetus for us to unionize, was seeing these long-term changes that were happening in the culture. And what we've always advocated for, alongside our own collective interest as employees, in our bargaining for a collective agreement, is advocating for, you know, policies in residence we support that let us do our jobs well, right?
Right, right.
And so what we've seen really since 2014, and especially it's really accelerated to a rocket pace since COVID, is that instead of managing this company, Student Housing and Hospitality Services, with a community-based, harm reduction-based mindset, the people who have been brought in to run this company now are from the corporate world. You know, they're people who work at banks. You know, they're people who were, you know, have a background in, like, business administration. And in a lot of cases, haven't actually ever lived in a university residence. They certainly haven't lived in McGill University residence.
Exactly.
And they are trying to, I would argue, there's been a cultural shift where we're moving from a community-based approach toward a top-down, no transparent, we're going to tell you how it's done, and that's the end of the story approach.
Wow.
And so I'll talk about a few ways that's kind of tangibly manifested.
Oh, for one second, I want to play the song that you suggested or recommended for us to play just for a quick break intermission. And I also want to mention that CKUT right now, they're doing their funding drive.
Woo-woo-woo!
So you can donate online at ckut.ca/donate or by phone at 514-907-9424. Or by mail. And the address would be Radio CKUT at 3647 Rue University. And then pledges can be made, checks, Visa debit, Visa, MasterCard, PayPal, all of the above. So really quickly, we're going to play your song, Graham, and it's California Dreamin' by the Mamas and the Papas, correct?
That is the one.
Awesome. Okay, so we're going to play it.
Thank you.
Hello, and we're back. Awesome. Graham, are you still there with us?
I'm still here.
Awesome. Okay, so we're running out of time. This has been an excellent interview. I want to round out with who is going to be replacing the floor fellows. I'm sure that you have your own opinions about it. And what I've really gleaned from this interview is that the floor fellows do a job that is very underappreciated, but very necessary for a very niche group of students, and that would be students that are still living in res, and really working towards that transition that would be living alone. So what can you say about the facilitators that are going to be coming into the floor fellows, well, taking their place next year?
Yeah, well, I think the switch from the floor fellow position to facilitators is interesting because it's not a replacement. So the facilitators, you know, if you just look at the McGill website, their training and their job does not include really anything beyond just like running events. You know, that's what residence life facilitators do. I don't want to denigrate events as a community building thing. You know, it's important, but floor fellows, first of all, we do our own events, but we do a lot more than that, and we're trained to do a lot more than that. We're trained to be the person, sort of the point of first contact. Mm-hmm. And I want to address something that has come up because, you know, like I said before, you know, we've been seeing that a little bit where we have residents saying, well, I don't know my floor fellow. My floor fellow isn't, you know, they didn't really do much for me. I don't see why it's necessary. And I want to circle back to that really quickly because I think this is like really important. I'll try to make it fast.
Yes, of course.
So in the last couple years, we've seen just in terms of how the floor fellows are managed by McGill, it's been a really, really tangible decrease in or sort of, you know, degradation of our relationship with management and how management sets us up to do our job. Mm-hmm. So just this year alone, we've had more disciplinary meetings for just the floor fellows alone, which is 65 staff,
wow,
than all of the 15 or 1600 casual support staff at McGill. Mm-hmm. So things like, you know, accidentally missing a meeting or leaving cells blank on an Excel spreadsheet, that is now cause for floor fellows to be called into a meeting with management and HR and
wow,
given kind of a disciplinary warning. So, you know, when I say that there's kind of a culture of fear, you know, unfortunately, that really is the case.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we talk about, obviously, there was news last year with the floor fellow room renovations, and I want to talk about that really quickly.
Yes, do.
Because I think that sometimes people misunderstand what our problem with that is.
Mm-hmm.
So our problem is not being moved into smaller rooms. Our problem with this policy is that we lost access to, lots of floor fellows lost access to their own private bathrooms and their own private spaces,
right?
Which makes the job harder. It's an incredibly emotionally taxing job.
Yes.
You know, a lot of the time, you have floor fellows who are, you know, at all different stages of life. Some of us are 19. Some of us are, you know, in our 30s. There's PhD students. There's floor fellows in med school.
Wow.
So
yes,
when you're living on a floor, mm-hmm, with residents who are a lot of the time like underage, and there's a power dynamic, mm-hmm, it's really difficult to not have privacy. It's really draining. Mm-hmm. And we warned, I was very clear in my conversations with McGill admin and our bosses at the time that this was going to degrade the ability of floor fellows, A, to do our jobs,
mm-hmm,
but also to care about our jobs, to go above and beyond, you know? The other thing that you know, needs to be said about that is that that plan was in place for 5 years, right?
Right?
During those 5 years, we were negotiating a collective agreement to get our working conditions with McGill. McGill declined to share this plan with us, which meant that, mm-hmm, after we'd signed our collective agreement, where, you know, the provisions about rooms are kind of pretty vague because we didn't expect this to happen,
right,
and we were locked into a collective agreement that says we can't strike,
mm-hmm,
that's when they dropped this information on us.
Wow.
And the other thing that's come out about the room renovations is we are actually being taxed more for smaller rooms with less privacy than for previously larger rooms with more privacy. In terms of why that is, we haven't really gotten a clear explanation. You'll have to ask McGill. But so coming into this year, right? Mm-hmm. I'm tripping over my words. Another thing I want to talk about.
Yeah.
Prior to COVID, mm-hmm, floor fellows were engaged in the floor fellow hiring process through a system called the carousel interviews,
mm-hmm,
which meant that before you had an interview with McGill, kind of the managers, you actually had an interview with a bunch of floor fellows. So you would go through, talk to like 10 different floor fellows for 5 minutes. They would take notes. Then the floor fellows would pick out who they thought would be a good floor fellow for which building. That was sent up to our managers. Then you were invited for an interview with the manager. And that's the system that I was hired by.
Right.
So let's talk about that. We've seen floor fellows being treated like a soccer ball. You know, when McGill needs to raise money, floor fellows are the first ones who get screwed over. Mm. You know, we're taxed more. Yeah, so we're bringing in smaller paychecks. We have very little consistency. We have no trust. We live in a culture of fear with management. And floor fellows no longer have a say in hiring floor fellows. So that brings us to this year when, you know, we have residents saying, well, I don't think my floor fellow is very engaged. It's like, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, right. Probably not.
It's, yeah, know? Right. So I think, especially from what you're saying, it seems like the environment has just completely changed. And I feel like it's interesting to note, it's also in line with the trends of the pandemic. Like, as mm-hmm. people are less apt to be social and, to be frank, less in practice with their social skills, it seems like we're having a decline in the quality of floor fellows, you know, read the different hiring process, but also just in terms of the residents not necessarily being, some not being willing to lean on that kind of resource.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's more complicated than a decline in the quality of floor fellows. And I want to stress by what I'm saying is that, yeah. You know, this is not the norm,
right.
You know, that residents don't feel supported by their floor fellows. And that's yeah. reflected in our testimony is
yeah.
lots of residents, and we're going to be hearing from them in the coming days when we yes. release the testimony we've collected.
Yes.
You know, have incredibly positive things to say about their floor fellows. Say, my floor fellow saved my life. You're talking about this year.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, floor fellows are not able to offer the same quality of service that we want to, and we could, because we're not supported to do so by administration.
Right.
Right, and I'll return to, and, you know, floor fellows, we've been very open with our bosses in McGill, and they're saying, you know, come to the table, and let's figure this out. Let's right. come up with a system by which we can do our jobs, because we know how to do these jobs,
yes.
you know?
Yes.
We have floor fellows, there are currently floor fellows working for McGill who have been here longer than mm-hmm. any of our bosses, mm-hmm. and know more about the institution than they do.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're not consulted, they're not asked for their input on how can we support our residents best.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
Okay. So that comes back to your question about the residence life facilitators.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I had a really interesting discussion with Dr. Norman Hoffman, who was previously the director of the McGill Mental Health Program, and I asked him what, you know, what the impact will be. This interview with him is going to be going out soon as well.
Awesome.
And he put it very bluntly. It's going to be an increased number of suicides in residents. It's going to be an increased number of dropouts.
Wow.
Wow. You know, and a kind of a decline in the quality of, you know, residents' community. And I think more than that, it's going to be, you know, it's going to be the loss of that personal relationship and that community vibe that McGill residents has had
mm-hmm.
and sadly have kind of been moving away from. You know, I was a resident in my first year in 2019, and I used to get emails from my residence life manager. You know, I actually spoke to him. I saw him in the halls. I saw him at events.
Wow.
You know, students and residents don't see their RLMs anymore.
It's true.
You know, the RLM has become a disciplinary role. They've mm-hmm. become disconnected. Floor fellows are kind of one of the last main vestiges of that real personalized individual community. And I think that seeing the end of the floor fellow position is going to be really, really unfortunate. So I guess I'll end with a call to action.
Yes.
You know, we right now have made clear that our intention is to sit down with, you know, the Deputy Provost of Student Life and Learning and our bosses and have a discussion about getting this decision overturned and, you know, equipping us to support our residents as best as possible. So my message for the listeners is, if you've ever been in crisis and you ever leaned on a floor fellow or a floor fellow ever made a difference to you, you know, the floor fellows are in crisis now, and we need you to be there for us. So please lend us your support, lend us your voice.
Yes. Graham, thank you so much for coming on to this interview. This is Evelyn Logan joined by Sequoia Kim, and this is Unfit to Print on CKUT 90.3 FM.
Thank you so much again, Graham.
Yeah, thank you for having me on.
and you, Kai Kello, and you are tuned into CKUT.
If it sounds like Montreal, it sounds like CKUT. CKUT's annual funding drive is back, and this year we're celebrating the city that made us. From Friday, March 15th to Sunday, March 24th, tune in for an earful of Montreal-made magic. Your favorite programmers will be live in studio and live streaming online for the first time ever. Tune in online, on the good old-fashioned radio, or join us in person. CKUT friends and family will be providing the tunes for an opening party at Bar La Marche à Côté on March 14th and a closing night on March 23rd at Nouvel Établissement. Stay tuned at our website for other events that put the fun in fundraising. Don't miss these celebrations of community radio and sounds of the city from your favorite local DJs. We need $50,000 to keep CKUT on the map. Powering a nonprofit radio station is more expensive than ever. Will you answer the call of your community before it's too late? Donate now by visiting ckut.ca/donate or by calling 514-907-9424. CKUT 90.3 FM, the sound of Montreal since 1987.